Blog Talk Radio.
Do you want Detroit sports talk done right?
Yeah!
If you want it, you got it. It's Detroit sports talk with attitude. It's the Knee Jerks with Eno and Big Al.
Listen, I like in July.
That's driven in the air toward left field, way back. Brandon is put the charge into another one. It's gone!
I like him a lot.
Culpepper. Jordan Dropkin as he throws. Deep downfield. Calvin Johnson. And he's going all the way. Touchdown, Lions.
Brent Diggins. And stuck. The reverse slam by Tayshaun Brent.
It's time to put on the knee brace and get ready for a workout. It's two guys who know Detroit sports. Here's Greg Eno and Al Beaton.
It's Monday, January 9th, 2012, 7 p.m. You're listening to The Knee Jerks, Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al. I'm Al Beaton, a.k.a. Big Al of WayneFonts.com, The Wayne Fonts Experience, and BlessYouBoys.com. Bless you, boys. Every Monday, I get together with the man I call Mr. Excitement, Mr. Old School, and names to, like I said, I can't come up with them all. There's so many nicknames for Mr. Eno, and that would be one, Greg Eno of GregEno.com. Greg, how's your new year going?
So far, so good, Big Al. We're just trying to muddle along here in the Eno household, as everybody else is, it seems like.
Ain't
nowadays.
That the truth?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you know, you wake up, I guess, anymore, if you wake up and somebody once told me if your feet are on this side of the ground, you're in good shape.
So yeah, no kidding.
That's what I try to subscribe to. But I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com. That's where you can read me every day of the week. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/GregEno. Follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter, thenkneejerks.info. And our Facebook fan page, of course, facebook.com/thenkneejerks is the way to follow us on Facebook. And if you are following us on Facebook, you'll know that in tonight's show we're going to be making an announcement very shortly about in a couple of minutes here about our new format coming up in February. But you'll also know that we have no guests tonight. Al and I are going to muddle along here, the two of us, until about 8:30 with, of course, a pause at 7:45 tonight for Adam Biggers of Yahoo Sports, who will join us for Adam Rants, normally on the first and third Monday of every month, but we had some technical issues last week, so we asked Adam to come back this week, so we will have Adam on tonight and next week. Happy to announce that next week, speaking of next week, we'll be joined by Tom Hannon of the Baseball Page, and Tom will give us an update on what's going on with the baseballpage.com, a very ever-evolving website that we have Tom on about twice a year to kind of keep us up to date on what's going on because it changes so frequently. That'll be next week. And then 2 weeks from tonight, Al, we hope to have our old friend Ray Scott, former Pistons coach. We're going to talk some NBA basketball with Ray, get his take on the Pistons and other NBA, his other impressions of other NBA goings-on. That'll be 2 weeks from tonight on January 23rd with Ray Scott. But as I indicated earlier, Al and I are going to change things up a little bit with the show. We decided that we're going to try to keep the podcast about 90 minutes every week. Al's experience with Bless You Boys podcast has told him the feedback he gets over there that's a pretty good number in terms of minutes to stick to. So what we're going to do is we're going to have Adam Biggers, as I've already said, on the first and third Monday of every month at 7:45. On the second and fourth Mondays of every month, in other words, the weeks that Adam is not with us, we will have a guest from 7 until 7:30. And in either instance, it'll be Al and I doing the show from about 7 to about 8:30 every week. So that's kind of the new format we're going to be adhering to beginning in February. So a guest every other week, Adam Biggers every other week. And in both instances, we get out of here about 8:30, about a 90-minute show. So, Al, any comments about the new format?
Yeah, it's... Yeah, to kind of go a little more in depth on what you mentioned about what I'm learning doing the podcast at Bless You Boys, and we've had some longer podcasts over there. I've gone like an hour and 45 minutes, and it's people tend to start to drift, is what we're finding out, and really they want at most they really want podcasts in that 75 to 90 minute range, and And it's tough for us, too. You know, it's tiring for us to go 2 hours straight yakking away and giving opinions and so on. And plus, it's easier for you, Greg. For people that don't really know how we put this together, I kind of handle the putting together the outline. I also handle the switchboard, kind of run things behind the scenes, while Greg does the guest wrangling. And I know, Greg, that can be kind of hard at times, trying to find someone every week. For essentially, we pretty much do this show about 50 weeks out of the year, give or take. So that can be, I know that we want to keep our guests a little fresher. We want to keep the show a little fresher. And realistically, shows need to evolve. And I think shortening things up, tightening things up, I think will be the best.
Yeah, I agree. I was, it's funny how these decisions kind of come by happenstance. We weren't really thinking about it until today. We just kind of exchanged a couple of emails, and we thought, you know, this would be a good idea to maybe just kind of trim this thing down to 90 minutes. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to do a 90-minute show this week, and we do have guests lined up for the next 2 weeks, so we'll see how that goes. But certainly beginning in February, we'll adhere to the new format, so I'm kind of excited about that. And with the high school senior, Al, in the house, that extra half hour to help her study for tests and what have you is also a good thing, too, which is what's going on tonight. So, you know, the real life also comes in there as well. I want to also mention that Al and I, of course, are already looking forward to our three-year show anniversary in May of 2012, here, about 4 months away. 3 years we will have done this show in May, and we always have, as listeners to the Need to Know, we have typically a whole plethora of guests to kind of help us celebrate and wish us happy anniversary, and we kind of have a lot of fun with it. Al and I are actually thinking about doing this show together in the same room at the Command Central, whether that's going to be at the Beaton residence or somewhere else, and he and I are going to actually be in the same room at the same time. Which for listeners of the Knee-Jerks, know that we've never done that. Not one time in the 2.5 years, almost 3 years we've done this show, have Al and I been in the same room at the same time. So we're thinking about doing that for our anniversary show in May, and that'd be a lot of fun. So I may go up to the Beaton residence up there. Are you in Oxford or Auburn Hills?
Actually, I'm just outside of Auburn Hills.
Okay, and we will might be doing maybe lifting a couple of celebratory drinks too, because it'll be 3 years. 3 years is a long time, Al.
No
to
kidding.
A podcast. It's
really funny how time slips by, because I didn't even realize it, but my blog's anniversary passed by this past week at the 6 years of doing the Wayne Fonz Experience. I didn't even think about it, you know.
And 6 years. Wow.
6 years. Yeah, 6 years. I think it was January 6th or something like that. January 3rd or whatever of 2006. And I'm like, holy. You know, the thing is, though, at this point, it's like I don't even think about it anymore.
I used to make
a big deal about it. Now it's like,
I've got 7 years. Out of bounds in April. Yeah, April of 2005 is when I started Out of Bounds. So, that's amazing. Unbelievable. Well, anyways, now that we've gotten done patting ourselves on the back, let's talk about what's going on tonight. Again, Adam Biggers at 7:45 with Adam Rance. But meanwhile, Al's got a lot cooking, a lot of Lions stuff tonight. So if you want to talk about the Lions, this is the right show to do it, because we're going to talk a lot about what happened, of course, in New Orleans, what's going to happen maybe in the off season, just kind of, maybe dissect everything as we always do. So, Al, before we do any of that, though, it's time for the first clue in Whose Birthday Is It, Maestro?
We baked you a birthday cake. If you get a tummy ache and you moan and groan and woe, don't forget we told you so.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
this is, of course, Whose Birthday Is It, a very simple game to play. I give Al a clue, or two or three, of a guest, not a guest, of a celebrity in the world of sports whose birthday it is today. That individual can be alive or dead. I'm happy to announce today's birthday boy is very much alive. He was born on this date in 1951 in Wallace, North Carolina. He attended Guilford College and was drafted in the 7th round of the ABA draft by the Kentucky Colonels in 1973, but never played for the Colonels because he was the final cut and ended up playing his first season of pro ball in Israel, where he won the MVP award in 1973-74 season. That's the first clue.
Oh, wow. Since I'm not an expert on either the ABA or Israeli basketball, I'm going to have to pass on this, and I'll wait for for question two from Betty White. So let's okay.
Well, not too many. I've got to tell you this, Alvin. Not too many pro basketball players, and he would eventually play in the NBA. But not too many pro basketball players went to Guildford, so they might want to listen.
Yeah, that too. I'm not an expert on that either. So
okay.
All right.
We'll give you another clue in my half. We'll give you another clue just before Adam Biggers comes on. Hopefully.
Sounds like a plan. All right, let's get going about really, there was the two big subjects we want to talk about tonight were Detroit Lions playoff game, and we can sneak it in. We'll talk a little bit about the Hall of Fame voting and the 80s Tigers getting short shrift again. But, Greg, wild card game Saturday. Lions actually looked great for about a half. Were in the game for three quarters, but lost going away 45-28. I mean, they had a 14-10 lead at the half. They were only down 3 points after three quarters, but I'm not surprised they lost. I'm surprised at how the fourth quarter kind of took place. It's like the Lions completely ran out of gas, especially their defense. But like I said, we're going to go in a little more depth as to whatever the hell happened that night, in other words. But I just found it interesting that you wrote in depth about this today at GregEno.com, where you're calling this playoff Martin Mayhew, the GM, his mulligan. So, for starters, why don't you go a little bit in on that? And I can see where you're going with this, and that for a lot of people, I think they were just happy the Lions made it this far and the season's a success. But, you know, this has to be the start of something more. This can't be the ceiling. I have a feeling that's where you're going with the mulligan thing.
Yeah, I mentioned it in the article on GregEno.com. This can't be the 1990s redo, mm-hmm. where we were teased into thinking that the Lions had a Super Bowl caliber team. We wanted to believe that they were better than they really were because they made the playoffs, I believe, 5 out of 6 seasons or something, but it kept getting drummed down the first round, with the exception being in 1991 when they beat Dallas. But other than that, they were always one and out, and it just never materialized beyond being a fringe playoff team. And my point today was that not too many people, like you said, gave the Lions a chance to really win that game in New Orleans. So certainly the results wasn't necessarily shocking, but my point being that with all the talent that Martin Mayhew has accumulated and as good of a job as he's done so far, his hardest work is yet to be done, and that's to go from fringe playoff team to serious contender. And that's the next step now in the process. And the mulligan reference was just to say that, you know, this is the one swing and miss that he gets. And then people from now on, I think in Detroit, the fan base are not going to be satiated with just making the playoffs. And this is now a team that's got a world-class quarterback, which they didn't have in the 90s, a world-class wide receiver, which is no apologies, I mean, no offense to Herman Moore. You know, Calvin Johnson is just so much better than Herman Moore. And, of course, they don't have a Barry Sanders, but they do have, potentially, if they get people healthy, a pretty decent running back by committee. And they've got, of course, some young people on defense and some pieces in the front seven. So this is not a team that is this team should take that next step. And it's up to Martin Mayhew now to continue to massage the roster, address the holes that are clearly there. And my point being, Al, is that mm-hmm. this is just not going to – going to on the road in the playoffs and losing in the first round is just not going to cut it beyond this year. And I think folks this year are pretty much going to give the Lions I'm not sure. I wouldn't say a free pass, but they're not. I wouldn't think they would get too much on their case because this was a very an accelerated year, I think, in their development. But I think beyond this point now, that's not going to be good enough. So that was my reference when I said mulligan that from now on he's got to start hitting some tee shots down the middle of the fairway because we've been down this road before with the one and done thing, and it's just not going to fly this time because there's too many pieces here for it to not. For them not to take that next step.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And it's, when we talked about this last week, we both agreed that the Lions had a better than a puncher's chance. It wasn't, it wouldn't have been a complete fluke if the Lions had won. And for three quarters, it pretty much looked that way. That it was this game may end up going down to the wire. But that's when we started to see. Well, through very a lot of the game, we started to see the holes that the Lions overcame, the of the roster issues all they've had all season long in one way or another started to – well, they started to – their patch job started to burst at the seams, specifically in the secondary. We know that they're missing – their guys are hurt. You know, Delmas – as much as they said, oh, Delmas is healthy for the first time in 5 weeks, you know he wasn't fully healthy. You know, Chris Houston's been in and out of the lineup all year because of, you know, hurting one thing or another. In this case, it's the shoulder. They're losing. They had some deaf guys missing. It was, and there was some underperformance going on there too. For all the talk there was of the defensive line being elite before the year, they really underperformed all season long. And when they really needed the front four to come up big, because one thing you can't do is blitz Drew Brees because he will chew you up alive. And he did it anyway, but you cannot leave your secondary on an island facing Drew Brees. So Gunther Cunningham didn't have any choice but say, my front four has to get the Brees. And they very rarely did. And the worst part, though, is when they did get the Brees and force mistakes, the secondary couldn't capitalize on them, as we saw by three dropped interceptions. And a couple of them were pretty much gimmies. So I guess it kind of leads to the discussion that there's a lot of calls right now, Greg, for Gunther Cunningham, the defensive coordinator, to be fired. Obviously, that's a, no pun intended, knee-jerk reaction, I think. But the cries on radio and message boards and for the most part, I think it's a lot of sports talk radio BS. They're saying, fire Gunther. And the problem I have with this is, one, we all know the Lions are lacking on defense, and you can only coach up players so much. Coaching them up only takes you so far. I mean, you have to have guys of talent, and for some reason, I think a lot of people have trouble grasping the fact that, Gunther can Gunther Cunningham can come up with the scheme of all schemes, and if he doesn't have the players to carry it out, it's not going to work. And I think that's what we saw this past weekend. So for the Lions to start doing what Wayne Fonts did back in the 90s and start switching out coordinators again, you know, every other year in the hope that, okay, this guy will finally correct our faults, it's really silly. It seems to me, Greg, that keeping continuity more than anything else and finding better players will fix the defense.
Well, okay, let's really look at what's going on here. The Lions won, if you recall, won zero games in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
They won two games in 2009, six games in 2010, and then 10 games in 2011. That, to me, indicates that things are going in the right direction on both sides of the ball. Now, obviously, the last two performances by the defense against Matt Flynn and against Drew Brees were very disappointing. Ironically, everybody kept talking about Drew Brees and worrying about what he would do to the Lions after what Matt Flynn did to them. And
right.
Brees, of course, did have a very good day, but what was, I think, really, what nobody really talked about was how the Saints were going to run the ball. And they ran the ball extremely well against the Lions.
Right.
Too well, way too well. That was almost a bigger indictment on the Lions' defense in the secondary. We knew the secondary wasn't very good. That it was a work in progress. It had a knack of intercepting footballs, but also had a knack of giving up a lot of yards. And so that wasn't, to me, as big of a surprise as watching the Saints gash the Lions on the running attack, which once I started to see that happening, I knew that the Lions' goose was going to be cooked because it was just not going to be – you just can't have that happen and have Drew Brees go off on you. It's just a recipe for disaster. It was bad tackling. It was over-pursued. They started a couple of plays where they let Ndamukong Suh just basically penetrate upfield, and they ran right by him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not sure this is a schematic thing, or if it's not. If it's bad gap management, by the other defensive linemen. I don't know, or the linebackers. I don't know, because I'm not a football coach. But I do know that once I saw the Saints gashed the Lions on the ground, that was not, even when the Lions were winning the game, I thought that this is not a good sign. They've got to clean that up. And they just didn't tackle well. They just didn't do very well against the run. And that was really, to me, the key. I think a guy could go off for 400 or 500 yards, and you can still maybe hang in there if you can keep them from running the football. But and you mentioned the missed interception opportunities and what have you, but this notion of firing Gunther, first of all, it's not going to happen. Jim Schwartz has way too much respect for Gunther Cunningham. They go back a long time. You know, you mentioned Wayne Font. Wayne, you know, changed coordinators on both sides of the football, offense
right.
and defense. And you're right; it was kind of an almost a whimsy. There was no continuity, and it was kind of a you know, panic mode. I remember when he fired Dan Henning, you know, midway through the season, and brought in Dave Levy, and it worked to a degree that, you know, they got to the playoffs, but he never had. You know, there just wasn't a good mix there. There wasn't,
right.
And they didn't have a franchise quarterback. But as far as Gunther Cunningham goes, he's not going to get fired. Number one. Number two, you know, I don't know that it's. I still think it's just a matter of not having the right having the players.
Yeah.
I think. But you know, here's what I will say though, Al. The only thing that I could say that maybe Gunther would have to answer to in terms of accountability. And he certainly doesn't have to answer it to me, but I mean, theoretically, he'd have to answer it. Is what happened to the front, to the defensive front? The defensive line, Al, wasn't as good in my eyes as advertised.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was going to be a real strength, not
yeah.
only for the Lions but in the entire NFL. And I didn't really see a whole lot of times where you could really point to that front four and say, "Boy, did they dominate!" Now, I had a good Monday night game against the Bears. They had a couple other good games throughout the season, but it was sprinkled. They really didn't consistently dominate like we were all told or we all thought they would.
Right.
And not just in Ndamukong Suh either. There were a lot of other players I thought that just didn't live up to the billing. And I don't know if that was just a matter of us here in Detroit, you know, kind of overemphasizing their worth. But there were other NFL-wide, you know, national people who thought that was going to be a strength as well. And I know Nick Fairley was hurt a lot and stuff like that, but it never really, to me, it never really materialized where that front four had those kinds of games where they were, you know, spending half the game in the other team's backfield and really, you know, causing havoc. I didn't really see too many games like that. And, you know, they really came up short in New Orleans. They were just manhandled. They couldn't tackle. It was just that was really a lousy way to end the season from the defensive front standpoint.
Yeah, it's. I think more than anything else, that was. I think you're right that as much blame as you want to put on the secondary, they're playing somewhat shorthanded, and they don't necessarily have the talent that we were told that the front four has, and it's been a kind of an issue all year. As you mentioned, there were some good games. Cliff Avril, for the most part, I think, had a very good year and is going to get a nice payday as a free agent. But I think pretty much everybody, and obviously, as you mentioned, Nick Fairley was hurt. But everybody else on the line, and specifically Ndamukong Suh, really underperformed. I mean, there was talk at midseason when those lists get put together, like most disappointing, and Ndamukong Suh was turning up on a lot of those, and people were saying, "Oh, you know, we're talking about a Pro Bowl player here." Well, as we all know, he didn't make the Pro Bowl, and essentially he was not nearly as impactful of a player as he was last year. You know, his sacks were down by about 7 sacks over the year. As we saw, he had trouble stopping a run, either being to a combination of being double-teamed and, as you mentioned, being over-aggressive, being so fired up to get sacks and get into the backfield that he would, I don't know if there was any responsibilities that he was, you know, if he was, because oftentimes in a defensive lineman, his job sometimes is just to plug the hole, you know,
right.
Rush the passer, not try to get the push in the line. Sometimes he's just there. His job is to just make sure the line doesn't move so their hole doesn't develop there. And as we've seen all season long, there's been very few teams that have had trouble running between the tackles. And as we saw it on Saturday night, the Saints had no trouble at all running between the tackles. And a lot of it was because what you mentioned was Suh, instead of trying to make plays on the running backs, was had his ear spin back and was going for the quarterback every play, and that's the sort of stuff that's got to change. But, yeah, if there was one thing I'm really disappointed about in the game, and for that matter, the season, is the play of the front four, and that has me wondering things like maybe it's time to move on from guys like Kyle VandenBosch, you know, the guy's definitely an outspoken leader on the defense, but the stats just aren't there anymore. Maybe it's time to make some harder decisions as to Who comes back into the front four next year?
Well, you mentioned Averill. I thought Averill had a Pro Bowl year.
Yeah, definitely.
He could have been voted to the Pro Bowl. It wouldn't have surprised me had he. It didn't surprise that he wasn't, but I thought he had a Pro Bowl type year. Vandenbosch, I think he was brought in to kind of bridge the gap between 0-16 and when this team was going to get better. You know, he was already, you know, on the back of the end of his career when the Lions signed him. I think he's 32 or 33 years old, and that's getting kind of up there for a D lineman, especially an end who you know plays as hard as Kyle Vandenbosch does. You're right. There may be some decisions, and I know that he goes back with Jim Schwartz in Tennessee, and so there's going to be some decisions that they have to be made there potentially. Averill's a free agent; they don't want to let him go for sure. He's a real talent. I really believe that. He's one of the few Matt Millen guys that really was a good selection. Corey Williams was pretty much nowhere to be found a lot of the times this season. I think they got some production out of guys like Sammy Hill and Willie Young. But
the stars needed to be stars, and the stars weren't.
Right, exactly. That's the thing. It's fine if you get that kind of production if you don't have Ndamukong Suh, and Nick Fairley. But when you do have those guys, those are the guys you should be talking about, not the Willie Youngs and not the Sammy Hills.
Exactly.
And Andre Fulowens and guys like that. You've got to be talking about that. I thought Lawrence Jackson played well for the most part. I just think overall as a unit, as a whole body of work, it was a disappointment. So that's the only area where maybe Gunther and Chris Kocharek, the defensive line coach, have to be kind of be accountable for, because I think the talent was there. I guess to be fair, if we're going to sit here and say, well, you can't get on Gunther's case for the secondary because they're just not quite there yet in terms of talent, well, then you got to get on his case when you're talking about a defensive line that does have talent, it does have experience, it has a good blend of youth and experience and talent that I thought personally was a disappointment overall. Now, was that because we overblew them a little bit and maybe gave them a little bit too much respect, a little bit too much benefit of the doubt, or was it that they literally were a disappointing unit? I think if you were to poll most of the NFL experts, they would say that was a disappointing year from the defensive line, from the standpoint of they didn't really have those games where you can point to and say, boy, the line that work of that front four really really changed what the other team wanted to do and really caused disruption. There really wasn't too many of that. There was I thought it happened on Monday night against Chicago, but other than that, they were good. But they weren't great, and that supposedly is the strength of the defense. And if that's the case, then it was a disappointment.
Yeah, and that kind of leads us to the fact that the Saints set a NFL playoff record with 626 total yards. Drew Brees completed an insane 76% of his passes, and he wasn't just dinking and dumping. He was throwing downfield and still completing an inordinate amount of his throws. So it kind of leads to the question, was the Lions defense that bad, or is Drew Brees that good? And I guess the real answer to that would probably be it's probably some mixture in between there Brees going off is not a surprise, but I really do think I thought that the Lions defense was at least better than they played. And sometimes you got to wonder when the plays that didn't get made, were the glare of the playoffs a little bit? Were they I don't want to say unprepared, but maybe again, this might lead to that Mulligan thing. You know, guys are going to make mistakes because the vast majority of this team, you'd probably say about 90% of them had never played in a playoff game NFL playoff game in their lives. So they're going to make mistakes, I'm thinking. But still, you can't allow Drew Brees to set up camp, be able to go down and go through four different receivers before having to throw the ball. I mean, that's ridiculous. And again, I guess what I'm saying, it all kind of leads back to the Lions' defensive line not doing their job.
Well, you can't, Matt Flynn carved them up, and he didn't really have a running game that day.
Not at all.
He really didn't. Mm-hmm. And so that was a concern. And then here comes Drew Brees, and then you give him a running attack on top of it. Now, obviously, Drew Brees, I mean, let's face it, let's keep some stuff in perspective here. Mm-hmm. Yes, he had a monster game. Yes, the Saints had over 600 yards of offense. Yes, they had 81 plays from scrimmage. But it's not like this is the only team that the Saints have done this to. I mean, this is
especially in the dome.
They're 9-0 mm-hmm. in the dome. They averaged 41 points a game in the dome. They put the stats up on the screen of the offensive stats of the Saints just in their home games. Drew Brees threw 29 touchdown passes in 8 home games. That's like a 58-touchdown pace for the mm-hmm. whole season. That's just crazy. So
yeah.
It's not like the Lions were the only teams that were victimized. Now, the Matt Flynn thing is a different story,
mm-hmm.
but you know, let's keep things in perspective of who they lost to, where they lost the game, and you know, who the quarterback was. We got to kind of keep it under perspective because this is not the first time that Drew Brees has done this.
No.
That being said, you know, I was hoping that the Lions were going to be a little more competitive. We were all looking pretty good there for a while. It was 24-21, I believe, at one point.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, okay, well, this is going according to script. You know, it was a track meet. It ended up being the kind of game that we thought it was going to be. Nobody was stopping anybody. The Saints never punted, but they converted three fourth downs. They converted a lot of third downs. Lions couldn't get off the field, as evidenced by the 81. To give up 81 plays is that's another alarming statistic. That's just incredible. But, you just have to keep it in perspective who this was against. This was not against Chop Liver. But by the same token, you know, you're not going to get anywhere, Al. You're not going to take the next step
mm-hmm.
until you can prove that you can occasionally stop a guy like Drew Brees or Aaron Rodgers or Eli Manning or Tom Brady or any of the other high-caliber quarterbacks, because that's what you're going to have to do if you're going to truly – you know, hoist that Vince Lombardi trophy. Sooner or later, you got to stop. When I say stop, at least, you know, slow down some of these guys, and they haven't really been able to do that yet. And that's part, I think, of the next process now is to try to clean that up so that it's not going to be a given every time you go out in the field that these guys are going to throw for 400 yards and 3 or 4 touchdowns on you.
Yeah, and I guess that is a good point that we do have to remember the situation. It's Drew Brees who... If Aaron Rodgers isn't the MVP of the NFL, then Drew Brees is. And Drew Brees also has thrown for 5,000 yards twice in his career, the only player to do so. He broke Dan Marino's season record this year in 15 games, not 16. And, there's no shame in losing to such a player of Brees' talent. And for that matter, a team that I don't think anybody would be surprised if they went all the way to the Super Bowl and won. I mean, the Saints are that good of a team, especially in today's NFL, where the vast majority of the games are going to be played in the dome, where the Saints, they dominate. You know, so it's I won't say disturbing to watch. It was a little upsetting to see. Brees do what he, you know, pretty much do what he wanted to do at will. But like I said, you're right. It's not just the Lions. The Saints have been putting 40 plus points on. That's like the fourth or fifth game in a row in the Superdome where they have done that. So it's I think what it comes down to, though, is that the Lions had really next to no. They were on a razor thin. Line here of they could not afford any kind of mistakes. They had to capitalize on every opportunity that came that way to win this game, and they didn't, pure and simple. They had some opportunities there, you know, and obviously there were some refereeing issues, which we'll talk about a little bit later, but they had opportunities going into the fourth quarter, and for whatever reason, be it a lack of talent, be it the Saints are just that much better, you know, be it active football gods, it just wasn't meant to be, and they didn't capitalize.
Our tackling was really poor. It's amazing, Al. It's amazing if you really watch an NFL game closely, mm-hmm. if you can somehow measure the amount of yardage that a team will get by virtue of breaking some tackles. The difference between a 3 or 4 yard gain turning mm-hmm. into a 9 or 10 yard gain, you know, is just so big in so many situations. And the Saints put themselves in second and short situations very often. Their third down conversions, they were never really in any third and long situations too often. They were very bold. They were very aggressive. They went for it three times in fourth down and converted all three. And because the tackling was really, really poor. It might have been the worst tackling game the Lions have had all year, which was unfortunately a bad timing for that. They haven't really had too many tackling issues, I don't think, but this was really a bad one. This is really a stinker in terms of that part of the game. But you know, hopefully they'll learn from this and they'll they'll retool. They'll massage the roster. They'll bring some people in here via free agency and via the draft, and get this thing continue to plug the holes, and take that next step. And this is going to be kind of fun, actually, frankly, to watch.
Yeah.
Because we've seen coming from the depths of where they came from to get to this point. Now it's going to be fun to see, because we've seen it happen with other teams. We've seen it with the Pistons, with the Red Wings, and with the Tigers.
Mm-hmm.
When you come from, don't forget, the Tigers went from 43-119 to the World Series in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that for a second.
Yeah.
43 wins, and then 3 years later in the World Series. That's pretty amazing. So
yeah.
We've seen it there. We've seen it with the Pistons. We've seen it with the Red Wings. So it'd be fun to kind of see how the Lions do now. Where will this path lead them now? I mean, they're to the point now where now they've taken those shackles of the Matt Millen era off them, and the 0-16 thing is all in the past, and now Jim Schwartz is going to be going into his fourth year, and they've made the playoffs, and what's next? And that's kind of fun. I'm kind of looking forward to seeing what's next.
Yeah, that's something we're going to probably get into in a little bit, exactly, because there are some very difficult decisions this team's going to have to make playing in a salary cap league. There's guys that are either going to have to hold off on extending, or they're going to have to let guys go, or the guy's going to have to renegotiate, or there will definitely be some changes have to be made. But let's talk a little bit about the offenses. And actually, there's not that much difference in the offenses. The Lions did put up a lot of yardage. Well, passing, there wasn't that much difference. Breeze threw for 459. Stafford threw for 380. He also had Stafford, I believe, threw for a couple touchdowns, ran for another. And, for his first playoff game for a 23-year-old, I have no issues with how Stafford played. And the two picks he did throw were about halfway through the fourth quarter when the Lions had fallen behind and they needed a quick score. He had to take chances and it didn't pay off. But the difference in the game, and you kind of referred to this a little bit earlier and how the Saints were able to gash the Lions' front defensive line was yardage on the ground. Saints had 197. The Lions had all of 32. And it would really show the difference in the game, I think, where was short yardage. The Saints were 7-11 on third down conversions and 3-3 in fourth down conversions. And when you see the Lions having to try and convert on short yardage, they were running misdirections. They were running end-arounds and cornerback bootlegs trying to get short yards when the Saints could just give the ball to Thomas or Sproles, and Sproles was able to run wide. Thomas was able to run between the tackles and get those first downs. That right there was a big reason why the Saints ran so many damn plays, because the Lions couldn't get off the field because the Saints had a running game. The Saints could get their defense off the field because the Lions had trouble converting on those short yardage situations. That is, for all, this is when we start talking about what you're going to do next year. This is going to be a conundrum about how to fix the running game. But, Greg, I want to get what's your take on really the two offenses and the disparities in the running game. Even if the Lions had a healthy job at best, I really don't see it. Think it would have been that much of a difference. I think this would have been the perfect game for Mikel Leshoure.
Oh, Mikel Leshoure, and how often have I mentioned Steven Jackson? I know I have a man crush on Steven Jackson, but Steven Jackson on the Lions, if the Lions could somehow get him, I don't know what his contract status is with the Rams. So he's playing for a 2-14 Rams team. His talents are completely being wasted over there. He's a very hard runner. To me, the perfect runner for the Lions offense. If you put him in the Lions offense, I think that the Lions would just be so much incredibly more dangerous than they already are, but you know, the running game, we knew, again, that that wasn't the Lions' forte, obviously. We knew that they couldn't really run the ball that much. 32 yards is just not, that's even, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, if you can at least get somewhere between 70 to 100, and at least keep the defense somewhat honest, but 32 yards on the ground is just absolutely embarrassing. And it wasn't like the Lions had to abandon the run, because they were within 24 to 21, you know, midway through the third quarter or whatever it was, late in the third quarter. So it wasn't like this was one of those games where they fell behind early in you know, the old Bobby Ross days where he would just abandon the run,
yeah,
you know, right away, like in the first half. No, I mean, you know, they were in a position to try to run the ball. They just couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's another thing that's got to be addressed is the running game. And right now the jury's kind of out on that because we don't know if it's truly that bad or it's because they're missing a healthy Jahvid Best and a healthy Michael LeSueur. We don't know.
Right.
I guess we won't know until those guys get back on the field. But, you know, sometimes it's not necessarily the runners. It's the blocking. It's the schemes. It's play calling, whatever you want to. You know, there's a lot of different aspects to it. But clearly, you know, the running game is just we knew this going into the season, but you know, it just – to get 32 yards in a playoff game, you know, not going to cut it.
Yeah, say the very least. It's there. You know, the Lions did have a couple of decent runs, you know, but there wasn't. You know, Kevin Smith had a handful of, you know, where it looked like he had a couple decent yards, but the Lions were missing that big play quotient that they really got from Jahvid Best. And of course, all season long, they have missed that short yardage, a back who could get that 5 yards when they really needed it. When they had the yard to get, he would get two. And it's ridiculous that an NFL team has to run an end around in third and short when you think about it. But again, that also leads to since we're kind of talking about this, is well, I might as well just bring it up. We were talking. Okay, we're talking about the Lions need to address the running game, but they also need to address, as we saw in the game, cornerback, probably linebacker. They also need to address probably the offensive line, and maybe even safety, because there's been complaints that Spivey is a step or two too slow, and obviously Delmas has trouble staying on the field, missing 5 or 6 games this year. So. Let me throw this out here to you, Greg. The Lions have taken a running back, a first-day running back, 2 straight years. They need to fix the running game. Here's a scenario I threw out to you. Say, since we know what Martin Mayhew likes to do, and that is take the best available player regardless of position. A team that's 0-16 can do that. I don't know if a team that is 10-6 that wants to go further in the playoffs can, but this is a scenario. Say the best running back left on the board is easily the best available player, but there is a cornerback or an offensive lineman who fills a more pressing need but isn't as talented. What do you do? And for that matter, what does Martin Mayhew do?
Sounds like a question that Jim Lange would ask on The Dating Game, put it. Boy, you know what? I still think that you go with the defense. I think that you can hide, or maybe that's not the right word. You can take a running back that's maybe not as skilled, and in the right scheme with the right blocking, he can be a serviceable runner. But I don't know that you can do that with a cornerback who's not as skilled. And I'm just thinking that if that were the scenario you just brought up were presented to me, I would take the cornerback.
Yeah, and I think we're both in agreement here when it comes down to it that the strategy's got to have to change with this team when it comes to player development. And it made sense two and three years ago, where the Lions they could have pretty much upgraded any position on the field, and you wouldn't have an issue with making the draft pick. Which is why at the time I had no problem with, for example, drafting Best and drafting Michael LeSueur, or for that matter, when they drafted Brandon Pettigrew a couple years ago. But now, you're right. Offense is pretty good. Is in pretty darn good shape. And if LeSueur comes back, Best has already said today he is planning on playing next year. He will be 100%. This is the time where you can't start. You do have to start hedging your bets a little bit, and maybe you take the less talented player that could actually fill a need for you. And I'm with you there. I take a cornerback rather than, say, the highest-ranked player on the board. And for the most part, I think that's what good teams are going to do, at least teams that are going to be drafting later in the draft. They are drafting more to fill holes than they are to upgrade talent. I mean, you're going to upgrade the talent anyway, of course. But, you know, what good is three first-day running backs going to do for you if Drew Brees throws for 600 yards? You know what I mean?
Right. Well, right. And secondly, mm-hmm. you know, you have to kind of trust what you've already done. You've already drafted Jonathan Best. You've already drafted Mecole Shore. Now, they've had injury issues, which, of course, is really no fault of your own.
Right.
But you have to have – if you're going to have it comes down to, do I have my faith and trust in these guys who I drafted in the last couple of years to, when healthy –
mm-hmm.
to be those players that we envisioned them being when we selected them. There's a reason these guys were drafted.
Right.
Now, if you're going to, you know, hold on to that and stay true to that belief, then you give Mecole Shore, you give Jahvid Best a shot, and you don't draft a running back. You go for a safety, you go for a quarterback, you go for offensive lineman. Eventually, like I said in GregEno.com today, they've got to – sooner or later, start looking for a left tackle and a center, because
right.
Loyola and Backus just aren't going to be there anymore in a few years. I mean, you know, it's getting to the point now where they're going to go into their 12th season, you know, and that's, you know, it's sooner or later you're going to start to have to address that, too. The interesting thing, though, Al, is that the
mm-hmm.
offensive line in the 3 years that Jim Schwartz has been in Detroit has been pretty much the same, with the exception
yeah.
of Rob Sims coming over from Seattle.
Right.
They've had the same left tackle, they've had the same center, the same right guard, and the same right tackle.
Yeah.
And that's not bad. I mean, there's some consistency, there's some continuity there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Gonzalez Cherwell has played a lot better this year than he's ever played in Detroit.
Right.
I thought Stephen Peterman has played pretty good. I thought they all played good in pass protection. The problem, of course, we go back to that grinded out, grunting running game. And what's really startling, Al, is that the Lions are so bad running the football on first down. That's where
mm-hmm.
they really get into trouble. They can never
right.
get a decent amount of yardage on first down on the ground. And that really hampers Scott Linehan's offense and what he can do, because he's constantly in second and long. He's,
mm-hmm.
how many times have you seen the Lions in second and 10, second and 11, second and 9?
Yeah.
Because that first down running play just isn't there for whatever
right.
reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's got to be cleaned up. Is it time for Adam Rance, by the way? That means that it's the first or third Monday of the month, but of course this time it's not, but that was because of technical issues last week, and that means that it's time for, at 7:45, Adam Biggers from Yahoo Sports with another edition of Adam Rants. And the way this works is Adam takes the floor for about 2 minutes and rants on whatever he wants to rant about, and Al and I react, either yay or nay in terms of agreement or disagreement. Adam, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, Greg and Big Al, thanks for having me, and hopefully there won't be any technical issues this week. Now, I would like to, before I begin my rant, let you guys know that I'm going to go back to being broke and miserable and return to my regularly scheduled programming after this is over.
Okay, that's I think we know what that's in reference to, but anyways, for the next 2 minutes, we give you Adam Biggers. Go ahead, my friend.
Well, if my opening didn't give it away, this week, I'm kind of burning a little bit on the whole Barry situation. Now, there's two sides to this coin, and in this day and age of social media and up to the nanosecond information, I think a story like this gets blown out of proportion. Obviously, I've loosely quoted what Barry tweeted, and if you don't know what Twitter is, it's pretty much either a great thing or the worst thing. In this case, it was the worst thing for Barry. Now, for him to vent his frustration after a game, after being targeted by Detroit Lions fans, I could kind of understand. When you look at a game like that where the Lions secondary was just torched for 466 yards, 240-yard-plus touchdown passes from Drew Brees, obviously if you're a safety or a corner, you're to blame for that, and you're going to get your fair share of licks from Lions fans, but you're also going to be disappointed in yourself. I think Jim Schwartz said it best, the Lions coach, that maybe Barry should have taken a deep breath before he took to Twitter to loosely say that the Lions fans would go back and be broke and miserable as to where he is not, apparently. My take on the situation is this. I don't think the whole Twitter, a guy tweeting something, should be blown out of proportion. You have to understand that he is a young guy. He was venting after a game with a lot of emotion. They were embarrassed. I know a lot of Lions fans took what he said to heart and thought it was kind of a personal shot. But you have to understand the magnitude of this game, and I think that Barry understands, too, the magnitude of this game for Lions fans. It was the first playoff game since 1999. They went in there an underdog. They played well, hung in with the Saints until halftime. And I think it's warranted for a young guy who's playing with a lot of emotion and could be upset with his performance, not grabbing an interception. I think it's warranted in this case to maybe give the guy a pass and say, we understand Lions fans should thank the Detroit Lions for a great season. It gave a lot of Lions fans something to believe in, a lot to look forward to next year. And I was listening to you guys, and I kind of feel like I'm along with you. I didn't expect the Lions to win. I'm glad that they kept it respectable in the first half. But on the same token, the Saints offense was just too powerful. Before you go and want to see Barry pack his bags, I think, as he should have before he took to Twitter, before you hit message boards, take a deep breath and kind of realize where this kid was coming from. I don't believe it was a malicious verbal shot to downplay or degrade the economic conditions in Michigan and suggest that everybody is indeed broke and miserable. I think he's just a kid venting out of frustration, and we should take it as that. And I'm Adam Biggers, and that's my rant for this week.
Well, you know what? The thing about Twitter and social media is it's such a double-edged sword. But the good thing about it, Adam and Al, is that these things are a very short shelf life. They don't last for very long. We're in such a news cycle now where, things stay in the news and stay in the public consciousness for such a short period of time. Unlike when you make a quote, an actual quote that gets reported and gets written in a news article and is actually spoken into somebody's microphone and somebody's tape recorder, still, to me, resonates more than somebody taking to Twitter, like Adam said, in frustration. I agree with Adam that I think he put it very well when he said that just as Aaron Barry should have taken a deep breath before he took to Twitter. They always say never write emails when you're angry. Probably the same thing goes for Twitter, because I know I've been guilty of tweeting while angry and using not very nice language. But I think that, just like Adam said, the fans also have to kind of take a deep breath and say, let's really think about what he was trying to say. But regardless of what you feel about the Aaron Barry tweet, it's not going to be in the news for very long, because that's the way this works. Twitter is a very short shelf life kind of a thing, and especially in this day and age of electronic media, social media. So it's never really going to be that big of a deal unless he really said something truly, truly heinous. And frankly, Aaron Barry's not that big of a star for it to cause much of a ripple anyway. So that's my take on it. Al, what you think?
I'll put it this way. There was a lot of bile being spewed by fans after that game, and a lot of it was directed at the players on the Lions defense, and there was hot heads to go all around. But the problem with Twitter, Facebook, and the like is that there's a lot of people out there who should be using listening to their inside voices saying, don't make an ass of yourself. But the internet tends to take away that filter, as the old thing goes, and anonymity makes normal people into complete assholes, for lack of a better word. And people that were tweeting at Aaron Barry were being absolute, I hate to put it, dicks. They, some of the stuff that they were saying was awful, and And as much as it goes, I know Adam referred to this about what everybody needs to take a deep breath. Fans really need to get a grip on some of this stuff. I can understand. We all posted on Twitter and Facebook how disappointed we were or upset we were at certain plays. But when you start directing your anger at specific players, when we really don't know what was going on behind the scenes, you know, say a play where Aaron Berry got burnt. Maybe it wasn't his fault. He let the guy go because he thought Louis Delmas was supposed to pick the guy up deep, and it didn't happen for whatever reason. Stuff like that goes on that we don't know that about. But the fans just say, oh, my God, he ran by Aaron Berry. Aaron Berry sucks. And that's the kind of stuff that players have to put up with. Fans really need to, I think, ratchet back the hate at least a little bit on Twitter. There's nothing wrong with saying you bitch about the referees, bitch about the score, bitch about the league in general. But when you start pointing fingers at players, when you really don't know for sure the exact reasons why things happen, that's just being an idiot.
Well, you know what? Also, too, MLive, forums like MLive are just, and they're not, and that's fan-on-fan crime there, MLive. Usually it's fan-on-fan. Some of those threads are really, really, really personal and disgusting. When people just, we've lost the ability, it seems like, and I don't want to take Adam's rant and really, I don't want to overblow it, but it seems like we don't know how to disagree in this country anymore.
A
civil fashion, without getting personal, without calling each other names.
No, you're wrong! I'm sorry.
It's physical now. It's physical, too. They have fan that got beaten up in San Francisco, for God's sakes, or L.A., whatever that was.
Lions fan got beat up in New Orleans.
Right, that's the other thing, too. But anyways, Adam Rants is a feature we have on the first and third Monday of every month. Adam will be here right next week, back here next week to put us back on schedule at 7:45. You can catch him on Yahoo Sports and elsewhere on the Internet. Adam Biggers, thanks so much. We'll see you next week, my friend.
Hey, thanks a lot, Greg. And if I could just real quick interject, I thought you made a very good point about a guy saying something without a microphone in his face. I can't help but think if a reporter approached him after the game that he might have not dialed back and thought about what he was going to say. I mean, it's so easy for these guys in the locker room to hop on their smartphone. I'm not sure exactly the timing of it and blast off 140 characters or less and say what's on their mind. But it's much more credible, I think, when he's face-to-face with somebody, and if he were to say this into a microphone, and then I think that, like you said, a real quote. This is just something that he said on Twitter, and I think it's nothing to get real overblown about. And the shelf life, too. I agree with you. It's a hit-getter, and that's the day and age that it's in. Gets a lot of hits, brings a lot of attention, and that in itself is a story. So I appreciate you guys having me on, and I'll enjoy the rest of the show from my couch, and have a great night.
All right, thanks, Adam.
You too, Adam. We'll see you next week. And let's do clue number two of whose birthday is it, by the way.
Right.
First clue was born in the state in 1951 in North Carolina. I was drafted in the seventh round of the ABA draft by the Kentucky Colonels in 1973, but I did not make the team, so I played a year in Israel where I became the MVP of the European Pro League. I found my way back in the States in 1975 with the St. Louis Spirits, where I played with Marvin Barnes, and I came over with Marvin Barnes to play for the Detroit Pistons in 1976 as a small forward, and I was here until I became part of the Bob McAdoo trade in 1979.
Oh, God. This should be right up my... Okay, let me think about this real. But the Bob McAdoo trade, that means it was involved the Celtics, right? And
right.
That would mean,
Boston.
Yeah, he went to Boston. So it has to be the most annoying cheerleader in the history of bench cheerleader in the history of sports, Mr. M.L. Carr.
Yes, it was. M.L. Carr is 61 years old today, M.L.
My God, we're getting old.
I know. Every year we say, every week we say that about whoever the subject is. ML coached the Celtics. He was the general manager of the Celtics. It was also the coach of the Celtics when the Celtics were 15-67, the worst season mark in the history of the Celtics. When the year they were accused of tanking to get a high draft pick, he was replaced by Rick Pitino. But ML Carr, 61 years old today from Guilford. And I don't know if too many other NBA players who were from Guilford, by the way, because Guilford isn't even a university or college, but So anyways, yes, so ML cars.
Yeah, and there's a generation of fans, I think, who only picture ML Carr wearing his green warm-ups, on the standing up on the bench, waving a white towel.
He was more on the bench than he was on the floor, that's for sure. In those days.
He was a pretty good player for the Pistons back in the day.
He was. He was a pretty good player for the Pistons, and then Dick Vitale, was just had his mind made up that he wanted that Bob McAdoo at whatever cost, and that's exactly what he got, was Bob McAdoo at whatever cost. But anyways, so that's
right.
Whose birthday is it? Well, to continue on with the rest of the you're listening to the New Jersey, by the way. I'm Greg Eno from GregEno.com and Big Al. Al Beaton from Wayne Fonts Experience, WayneFonts.com, of course, is here. And next week, Tom Hannon from the Baseball Page will be with us. And 2 weeks from tonight, Ray Scott, former Pistons player and coach, will be joining us to talk about the NBA. So that's what's going to happen in the next couple weeks. So now let's continue on with what you got.
All right. Since we were kind of talking about what we're looking for, we got kind of off track here of our discussion. There's one thing I want to talk about before we move on to what the Lions may do in the draft free agency and what decisions they have to make. And we have to talk about the refereeing. The NFL today admitted they blew the call on the Breeze fumble. That should have been first off, it should have been Lions ball, but they admit they blew that the whistle shouldn't have blown. But since the whistle shouldn't have blown, did blow, that means they even screwed that up in that it should have been Saints' ball rather than giving it the ball to the Lions the way they did. So the referees actually screwed up twice on that one call. And then there is also what I actually posted on Twitter as the worst effing call spot ever.
That gave
the Saints a first
down. Don't get me started on that.
Yeah, it gave the Saints the first day. It was like, third and 10, deep in their own territory.
Cool.
And he threw a 9-yard pass. He was spotted at like 11 yards. And I actually posted I took a screen cap of it on Twitter, and it was blatantly obvious that it was it gained 9 yards, and they would have had the punt. But as Schwartz has been asked about this a few times since, and he says, and he's right that the referees just kept the game rolling, didn't ask for a measurement, since they didn't ask for a measurement. There was no time for Schwartz to get word from the booth as to any replays, and the plays just kept going. Because I know I was yelling at the TV, throw the challenge flag, you'll win this one. But as Schwartz said, he at the time he wasn't confident he would win because he didn't have a good angle there from the ground. But this is not the only time we've seen bad refereeing. We've been seeing bad refereeing all season. We've seen it in the playoffs. We saw it in the Denver game yesterday. And this is another thing I've written is that the Lions for the Lions to get a better record next year, they don't need a running back, they don't need a cornerback, they need better refereeing. So, the time has come, I think, in the NFL that the technology is there. The review system, God forbid, needs to be overhauled. The challenge system is ridiculous because more often than not, as we've seen, you need more than two challenges. There has to be more of a booth review kind of thing like they do with the NCAA. And the technology is there where they could put trackers in balls. They can use GPS. There's all kinds of different things that they could use to make sure they get calls right. And for that matter, with the camera angles they have in most of these stadiums anymore, there's more things that you can review other than is it a touchdown or not. There's all sorts of different right now, the rules are they're too screwed up. I mean, next time I hear process of the catch, I am going to go ballistic. I mean, I heard it like 3 or 4 times over the weekend. Right now in the NFL, with the refereeing and the rules, I don't know what's possession. I don't know what's a catch. I don't even know what's a touchdown anymore.
The incentive, Al, that you would think that the NFL would have in terms of implementing some of these things that you're talking about, and you're right about having the technology and certainly having the ability to do this, is you would think that the incentive would be that they would not want fans talking about calls affecting games as much as they are right now. And as many calls as you can get right, if you can get them right, then there's that much less talk around the core on Monday morning about a call that was blown. You know, I mean, this to me the most egregious in the plot here is not reviewing plays that were not called touchdowns on the field that might be touchdowns. You know, that's to me that's going to be around Detroit, going to be known as the Titus Young play in Green Bay, where you know there was ruled not a touchdown on the field, so therefore not automatically reviewable like all scoring plays are automatically reviewable.
But now, and remember, if it had been called a touchdown, automatic review. It's goofy.
Right. So that's got to be addressed. I'm with you on the number of challenges. I think that's become passé. I think initially when they first brought the replay into the NFL back in, I think, like 1986 or 87, whatever it was, you know, to limit the amount of challenges and keep things moving along was probably a good thing. But now, like you said, especially with the NHL able to, you know, for once here we are, you know, extolling the virtues of the NHL, but they're able to have a command center in Toronto that looks at all these plays and all these games that are happening right at that moment, and they're able to, you know, get word to the officials on the ice at that arena when something needs to be reviewed or something is not right. And they seem to be able to do without a whole lot of delay. I mean, you're going to have some delay. I think fans, though, Al, are okay with delays if it means getting the right call.
Right.
And I think that the amount of time that is spent on a delay can only be made shorter and shorter the better that we get at this whole thing. Now, here's the problem with the whistle situation. We saw this in New Orleans with the Drew Brees fumble. I also saw it in Denver. I think it was in Denver I saw it as well, where there was a quick whistle.
Yeah.
These guys have got to stop blowing the whistle so fast. I would rather a play kind of play itself out with a late whistle than I would have a play stopped because of an early whistle. Because when we have an early whistle, you pretty much handcuff everyone. The league office, the replay official, everybody's kind of handcuffed at that point because with an early whistle, it's prematurely stopping the play. I would rather see them be a little bit more disciplined in blowing the whistle and waiting for these plays to kind of play themselves out a little bit before they blow the whistle. Because to me, it's easier to fix a play. To me, it's easier to fix a play where the whistle went late than it is to fix a play where the whistle went soon. And that's another issue. And I know it's a tough one because now you're talking about human instincts. And I know these guys have been trained all their lives to blow the whistle sooner rather than later, mainly because they didn't want to get anybody hurt. And I understand that. I'm with that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some plays where I think, you know, like when there's a change of possession, the football is bouncing around the field, like it was with Drew Brees' play Saturday night. When that football is bouncing around in the open field, that's not the time to blow the whistle, in my mind.
Right.
Or the only person who should blow the whistle in a situation like that is the referee. Instead of, because they got so many guys out there who've got whistles in their mouths, of course. All it takes is one of them to blow it, and everybody's got to, you know. So I would really like to see them do something about early whistles, because that is really frustrating. And that, typically, Al, how many times it seems like that when a whistle is blown early, it's wrong.
Yeah.
and that's the problem. But, no, you're right. There's a lot of avenues that can be taken here that are certainly doable, are certainly within the realm of possibility, would not cause a lot of headache, despite what Mike Pereira would try to argue, or like you argued with Brian Billick a couple weeks ago. You can do this a lot easier than what some of these people are making it out to be. And, it's got to be massaged. They got to look at it. And they've opened Pandora's box. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube now. Replay is here to stay. You got to live with it, so you got to make it better. And like you said, I don't know if I would go so far as to make it reviewable on, you got to be careful what you're going to review. You can't review every single thing, obviously. You can't review holding penalties and things of that nature. But, you know, there's so many plays. And it seems like, Al, at any NFL game, and again, I go back to the Denver game, where there was another one of these bang-bang plays, just like Matthew Stafford's touchdown run, where the guy fumbled. I can't remember the Pittsburgh running back's name. I can't remember his name. Who fumbled? It wasn't a fumble though, but he lost possession of the football right as he was being tackled at the goal line. They got the call right. I mean, they got it right. But it just seems like there's so many of these plays anymore that are just reviewable that Really, you can't hide replay now. The replay is just way too – it's become such a part of the game now. It's almost like, you know, how special teams is a third part of a football team.
Mm-hmm.
Replay is like another portion of officiating that's its own entity and its own monster, and the NFL hasn't quite figured out how to handle it yet, and they've got some work to do in that area, I think.
Indeed. All right, we got about 20 minutes left in the show, so let's now got a couple of topics where we call it a night, and – I start watching the BCS championship game, and you start helping your child with homework. And
yes.
All right, this off season, there are some needs that are become pretty obvious: running back, cornerback, linebacker, safety, offensive line. It seems like a lot, but I think more than anything else, a couple of those positions I think need depth more than anything else, and others you could probably get. You need a starter, so. If you're targeting something, Greg, if you're Martin Mayhew, what position are you targeting? Are you you going for corner, safety, linebacker, or maybe you're looking for a replacement for Jeff Backus, who had surgery on his on a torn bicep today?
Well, don't forget, I think Justin Durant, is he not a free agent?
I believe he signed a one-year deal as well, so yeah. Actually, I think almost all linebackers are on one-year deals.
Yeah, you have to. That's going to play into it as well, depending on who they bring back from the linebacking core. That's yet to play out. But right now, the draft for tomorrow, I would say that you would. I would say you would look at safety more than you would look at cornerback at this point. I think that so much of the NFL right now, so much of pass defense, I should say, is predicated on safeties.
Mm-hmm.
Saving the day, so to speak, and safety positioning, or in many cases, safeties being out of position, frankly, is what kills pass defense more though. In my mind, more so than just straight up man coverage by the corners.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say that the Lions don't need an upgraded cornerback, because they do. However, I think their cornerbacks are not as bad as the safety play has been. I think the safety play, especially with Delmas missing some games. Spivey being benched on a couple of occasions this
right.
year. And they had some issues, of course, injury-wise back there as well. I know that. John Wendling, who's really more of a special teams player, has had to come in and play significant
mm-hmm.
time due to injury. And I get all that. But it seems like in today's NFL, when you're trying to construct a pass defense, it seems to me that instead of working from the corners out, you work from the safeties in. And
mm-hmm.
I think that the Lions could get another guy next to Delmas in the safety position that is a real ball hawk and a real fast guy and who reads and reacts well and is as smart as they come. That's where you go first before you get a corner. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Now we don't know who's going to be available in the Lions draft, where they draft. We don't know. There's a lot of variables, obviously. But if given the choice, I would draft safety before I draft cornerback.
Yeah. Now, the only thing is that I would I like your thinking, but one thing you have to keep in mind, I have a feeling that Martin Mayhew is really, really, really wants a cornerback, because as we've heard this season, there was the reports on draft day or a little after draft day that Mayhew really wanted to get Patrick Peterson so bad he almost offered damn near the entire draft to move up to try and draft him, and the Cardinals turned him down. And there was also just recent rumors that actually during camp that the Lions had a deal on that was pretty much set to go for Asante Samuel from the Eagles, and that
right.
fell through for reasons that no one has really talked about. So there must have been something up with the compensation or some such. But that deal almost went through as well. So it really goes to show that I think Martin Mayhew wants a cornerback, and he wants a cornerback bad. But I tend to agree with you that I'm fine with Wright and Young at cornerback as long as you either have, you know, as you're saying, you want that Ed Reed, Troy Polamalu type
yep.
at safety,
right.
or you're
right.
getting monstrous pass rush out of your
right.
front four, and then you can get away with your average to maybe good cornerbacks. So I'm with you there. But I'll ask you a thing about this, too. You're right. All this also depends on free agency as well and what the Lions have to do. Right now the Lions have Cliff Averill's a free agent, Stephen Tulloch's a free agent, Jeff Backus a free agent, DeAndre Levy's a free agent. I think we were both in agreement. We believe that Justin Durant's a free agent. You can't keep them all. And for that matter, you have a guy like Megatron, Calvin Johnson. He's got a cap hit next year, $20 million. That's got to be renegotiated. The only way they can do that is by giving him a contract extension so they can rejigger the money. So
right.
There's a few of these guys are either going to have to take pay cuts or they're, you're just going to have to let them walk. And I have a feeling that I don't know if the Lions going to be able – much as I would love to see them keep Cliff Avril, I have a feeling they can't afford him.
I hope you're wrong because I think Cliff Avril is going to be one of the top defensive ends in pro football within the next 5 years.
He's young and good. You hate to give that up.
I think he's going to be a real monster for someone, and I hope it's with the Lions. He could be one of the best defensive ends that we've seen in Detroit since the likes of guys like Michael Colfer and guys like that who are outstanding defensive ends. But I think that the problem though with all this money situation is that you have to look at. Well, I shouldn't say the problem with the. I guess encouraging thing is what I'm trying to say, not the problem. The encouraging thing about it is that if you look at teams like New England, who reload and let players go, frankly, that are not bad players, but like you said, you can't afford to keep everyone in the salary cap world.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to – the decisions that become – that you make as a personnel guy can make or break your franchise. And where the Patriots have been able to be so successful – is they've been able, and the Packers to a degree too, they've been able to pick and choose, and they've made the smart, right now sometimes you got to get lucky, I understand that.
Yeah.
But they've been able to make decisions in keeping certain guys and letting other guys go that have been the right decisions. And now, not that those guys that they've let go have been ended up being scrubs on other teams, they've actually, some of them have gone on to be productive players, but they just know how to pick and choose, and frankly, that's where the draft comes in, and that's where the replenishing comes in. In this day and age, Al, to be consistently good in the NFL, like the Patriots have been, and a handful of other teams, and it's only a handful, Steelers and just a couple other teams, is phenomenal. When you consider all the rules and regulations about free agency, about contracts, salary caps, it's unbelievable that and frankly, where they're drafting. These guys are drafting constantly low, obviously, because they're always finishing so high. So it's amazing that they've been able to string together this many seasons of constant Super Bowl contendership, if you will, working in today's NFL, because that's not an easy thing to do at all. And have they gotten lucky? Sure. But where have those teams been the best at? They've been the best at quarterback. They've had great, you mentioned Polamalu over at Pittsburgh and Ed Reed, great safety play, great quarterback play, strong running attack, offensive lines that have stayed together. In the key areas of pro football where it really matters, let's cut right down to the chase. That's where those teams have been strong at, and that's where they put their bread is buttered on. Is in those areas, and they realize that, and they're able to reload it in other areas. And it's got to be. I mean, hey, say what you will about guys like Bill Belichick. And, whomever, but guys like Mike Tomlin and Bill Belichick, Mike McCarthy, these are good football coaches, and they've got, good assistants, and this isn't a fluke. You're not good in the NFL for 10 years in a row by being lucky and lucking your way into it. It's a process. It starts up top. The Colts, unbelievably, just fired Phil Polian, of all people, who's one of the most, to me, was one of the best at what he does. He's been fired, but yet Jim Caldwell stays. It's unbelievable to me what happens sometimes in the NFL. But give these guys their due, because when you have a personnel guy like a Bill Polian or who they got over there in New England, I can't remember the guy's name. These guys are gold, and I'm thinking that Martin Mayhew is developing that kind of a thing right now. Time will tell, but it's just so hard to be good in the NFL for that long.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the Lions are going to have to do. And another thing, remember that teams like the Pats seem to be able to do is to sign players at a discount, older players who still may have a productive year or two left to fill gaps. I mean, look at the So I have a feeling the Lions may end up having to do that, at least with a couple positions where they'll sign guys on 1-year deals, like they did with Tulloch. And those guys may not necessarily return. Unfortunately, that's the way it is in the NFL nowadays. All right, Greg, we got about 12 minutes left in the show before we call it a night. We got to at least bring up the Hall of Fame voting and Cooperstown. And there will be no Tigers going again. The only person voted in was Barry Larkin. I believe he got 87% of the baseball writers' votes. Surprisingly, Jack Morris is actually getting up there now. You need 75%. Morris got 67%. And amazingly enough, Alan Trammell, who has almost identical stats to Barry Larkin, and Barry Larkin is closely a no-brainer Hall of Famer, Alan Trammell only gets 37% of the vote. At this point, Greg, I think if a Tiger's going to make it into the Hall of Fame, it's going to be through the Veterans Committee. I think that's their only chance at this point.
I was talking with Jerry Green today, and he was telling me about how for years he lamented how he never voted Nellie Fox into the Hall of Fame. And Nellie Fox missed the Hall of Fame, Jerry said, by one vote.
Really?
At one point. And it was the year that Jerry did not vote for him, and he felt awful about that. Now, years later, Nellie Fox did get in. He was voted in by the Veterans Committee, and I told Jerry that the Veterans Committee is a double-edged sword, though. They're good to right the wrongs, but they're also guilty
An
of
old boys
of voting,
network.
Voting, right, and voting people in that shouldn't be in.
Yeah.
Phil Rizzuto should not be in the Hall of Fame. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Ralph Kiner shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. You know, there are guys that were maybe very good for 5 or 6 years. If you look at Phil Rizzuto's numbers, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. The only reason he's in is because he's a Yankee. They played in a lot of World Series teams. I understand that. But just because you play in the Yankees doesn't mean you're a Hall of Famer. And unfortunately, that's the way it was looked at with Phil Rizzuto. Now, having said that, Morris did make a jump, quite a jump, actually, from 53% to 67%, which is quite a leap. The Trammell thing... I don't know how to explain that. I really don't. I don't understand why it's been such a low total for him and Lou Whitaker both. Maybe because the Tigers didn't win a lot. They only won one World Series, one other divisional title. But I read a stat today that the Tigers are one of only three teams, the 84 Tigers are one of only three teams to win a World Series that never had a Hall of Famer on it. Which I thought that was an amazing statistic to begin with. I didn't know there were that few teams that pulled that off. But, you know, I think Morris will get in, though. I'm encouraged by the leap. I think he will get in. I don't know if it'll be – how many more years is he on before he has to go to the Veterans Committee, do you know?
That I'm not sure. I think at least five or six, I think.
Okay, so he might not need the Veterans Committee.
Yeah.
If he went from 53 to 67, he might get to 75. Kind of be like a Burt Blyleven kind of a guy.
Yeah. He might be one of those guys who will sneak in right towards the end there, but it's going to be, I think either way, if he gets in, it's going to be right at the borderline.
Yeah.
Yeah, because a lot of people pointed at 390 ERA, even though the reason he's got such a high ERA is that he hung around too long trying to pad his stats a little bit, and I think in the end, hanging around those extra 2 or 3 years may end up costing him. You know, and before we start wrapping things up, if there's one criminal Tiger, if there is even more so than Trammell, I think, or just as criminally negligent as Trammell, is how Bill Freehan has been ignored over the years as a Hall of Famer. When he was maybe, if not the best catcher in the American League in the 1960s, he was easily top three.
Bill Freehan was the best catcher in the American League for about eight years in a row. He was always the starting catcher in the All-Star game. He was always there really wasn't anybody who was even close to Bill Freehan in terms of putting the whole package together, defense, offense, leadership, you name it. I've written before that Sparky Anderson should never have been allowed to wear number 11 to begin with because that was Bill Freehan's number, and Bill Freehan never gets his due in Detroit in my mind. And it's really weird because he's a local guy. He went to the University of Michigan. I mean, he coached Michigan baseball after his Tigers career. He was a broadcaster. He was very much involved with the community. And he never really, to me, got the kind of notoriety that he not only nationally but locally that I think he should have. And you're right. Bill Freehan was without question, to me, the best catcher in baseball that was not named Johnny Bench for quite some time. So you could say that he played in a time where maybe the American League was kind of weak at the catcher position, but he was still the best. And
and his numbers hold up for that era. They're elite for that era as a catcher.
Right. I'm sad to report. I don't know if you know this or not. Bill has Alzheimer's now.
Really, I did not know that.
Yeah, and that's a shame. He's not doing well, and he's in poor health. I got that from Bob Cage. And so that's unfortunate, but, I agree with you about Freehand. I agree with you about Morris. I've always enjoyed Hall of Fame debates. To me, it's the most, mm-hmm. it's the funnest conversations you can have
yeah.
with somebody who you don't even really know. It's just to debate who should be in the Hall of Fame and who shouldn't. To me, it's fascinating. And the Barry Larkin thing, you're right. If you go strictly by numbers,
mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with the you made the Ozzie Smith comparison with Al
yeah.
Farrell, I think,
right.
a few minutes ago. The same thing, you know. I mean, if you but obviously, I guess what that says, Al, is that Hall of Fame worthiness is
mm-hmm.
not just based on numbers.
Yeah.
It's got to be based. There's got to be other intangibles there, which I don't know. And that, I think that's what kind of what makes it fascinating to me, is because there's that subjectivity to it. If we all just voted on the Hall of Fame based on numbers and said, okay, everybody who gets 2,500 hits, you're in. Everybody
yeah.
who gets 500 home runs, you're in. Well, that wouldn't be as fun.
Mm-hmm.
The fun comes in guys who have comparable numbers, where one gets in, where one doesn't. Jack Morris won more games than Don Drysdale. He won more games than a lot of players that are in the Hall of Fame right now. It has to do with who you play for, when you played, were you nice to the reporters, were you not nice to the reporters. Now, that shouldn't matter because there's nothing on the ballot that says that somebody has to be nice to be in the Hall of Fame. But let's face it, there are people who didn't even vote for Ted Williams because they had personal grudges
yep.
against him.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
wrong, obviously. That's wrong,
yep.
obviously. And then the hell with the clown this year who didn't vote for Justin Verlander for MVP because
yep.
he didn't think that in his little world, he didn't think that pitchers should be eligible for the MVP. So he,
mm-hmm.
that's not right either.
Yep, exactly. No arguments for me, Greg. And we need to wrap up this podcast as we want to keep it at around 90 minutes. So, Greg, real quick, let's knock out our jerk of the week. Who do you have as your jerk?
Well, I didn't get to this last week. This actually happened a couple weeks ago because I had another jerk of the week. But I'm going to name the entire Detroit media, and more
mm-hmm.
the print media than the electronic media, the Detroit print media for drastically underreporting the death of former Red Wings coach and player Johnny Wilson, who passed away between Christmas and New Year's.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny's death was completely overlooked. Not given the time of day, barely. And this was a guy who, for many years, had held the NHL record for consecutive games played. He was the original Iron Man before Gary
yeah.
Unger came along and the other guy who came along and broke Unger's record. But you know, he was the original Iron Man. He played on several Stanley Cup winning teams with the Red Wings. He coached the Red Wings, I thought, cut the shaft entirely when he got fired by Ned Harkness as Red Wings coach. Was the lone bright spot in a decade of bad coaching hires that the Red Wings had in that time. Very nice gentleman. Very honored to have moderated a roundtable with he and Ted Lindsay and Sean Burr a few years ago about hockey.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice man, and his death was completely underreported. Bob Page sent me a write-up that was done by a New York guy about
yeah.
Johnny Wilson that was way better than anything I saw in the Detroit papers. So shame on the Detroit media for underreporting the death of Johnny Wilson.
All right. My jerk of the week is the NCAA bowl system, and I'll just put it this way. You want to make your game completely and totally irrelevant. Put it on the Friday night before the NFL playoffs and the national title game, and put it on Fox. For example, the Cotton Bowl. Like, if no one watched because of the time, because of when they. And then yesterday, last night, 9 o'clock. There's the GoDaddy.com Bowl. Who is going to watch the GoDaddy.com Bowl after watching four NFL playoff games? And then you got the national title game tonight. Yet they felt that they had to have another bowl game squeezed in there. That is absolutely ridiculous. The bowls have spun out of control, Greg. I can understand at least the big bowls that they kind of stretch them out for the TV, you know, for the sake of television. But there is no reason to put the Cotton Bowl on the sixth, and have the GoDaddy.com Bowl on the eighth. That is absolutely ridiculous. So I'm out of breath. I just get so upset thinking about it. But yeah, my jerk of the week is the bowl game system as a whole, and the ridiculousness of playing bowl games a week and a half after New Year's. So, Greg,
well,
I
you
think
know what?
Yeah,
the only way I would watch the GoDaddy Bowl that they would have good ratings for GoDaddy Bowl this late in the game is if they trotted out Danica Patrick in the bikini.
I guess maybe we should just say my jerk of the week is the GoDaddy Bowl for even existing. So maybe we should put it at that. So, all right, Greg, we need to wrap this up so we can do our things and make this a 9-minute podcast. So please, if you could, credits and thank yous and do what you do best.
Sure. Thanks to Adam Biggers, of course, from Yahoo Sports for another fun edition of Adam Rants. And he'll be back with us next week to get us back on schedule. Thanks to him. Also want to remind everybody next week we'll have Tom Hannon, our old friend from the baseball page, updating us on what's going on with the baseballpage.com. 2 weeks from tonight, Ray Scott, former Pistons player and coach, will be here as well. I want to also remind everybody that you can follow the Neatrix on Twitter. You go to thenatrix.info. I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com. You can read me every day of the week there and follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/GregEno and follow the Neatrix on Facebook, facebook.com/TheNeatrix, and also write us at TheNeatrix@gmail.com if you'd like to drop us a line. I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon, and thank you, Big Al, for making Monday Night So Special.
All right. Thank you, Greg, as well, for taking the time out of your Monday night to join me. As always, you can find me at on Facebook. AlBeaton.com is a shortcut. You can find me on Twitter. Use BigAl.us. Of course, you can find me almost every day at WayneFonts.com and, for that matter, at BlessYouBoys.com, where I also do the Bless You Boys podcast, which you can find on, as well as this one, on iTunes. Greg, I think that covers it. As Greg said, keep an eye on Twitter and Facebook for the latest that's going on with the Knee Jerks. But until next Monday night at 7 p.m., this is Al Beaton saying aloha.
Shout out to everybody. We'll see you next week. Good night.